VCY America presents Crosstalk, a nationwide call-in program discussing issues that have an effect on our families, our communities, our churches, our nation, and our world. Crosstalk, an opportunity for you to voice your concerns for biblical principles. And now live by satellite and around the world on the internet at vcyamerica.org. Here is today's Crosstalk.
And thank you for joining us on Crosstalk today here on VCY America. You know, one of the mantras that we hear in our society today is follow the science. And by that, you're going to be hearing a plethora of ideas that come forth on a wide variety of issues, everything from so-called man-made global climate change or responses to COVID or the shot or any variety of ways to just follow the science. Yet, if you find, ladies and gentlemen, that this is not always something that they follow their own advice. For instance, science is often denied when we get to the politically correct topics like gender, whether one is biologically male or female, or can that change? Then it's okay to defy science. Another matter that's also influenced is the matter of origins. There are those who advocate that one must be an evolutionist if they truly follow the science, that one must believe that all of life evolved if we just follow the science. Well, our guest today will take exception to this claim. Joining us in studio today, Dr. Kevin Anderson. He earned his PhD at Kansas State University in microbiology. He's the director of the Van Andelen Creation Research Center, as well as a project leader of the Creation Research Society's iDino project. It's an investigation of the preservation of tissue and dinosaur fossils. He has held university professorships where he's taught graduate-level molecular biology classes. He served as a major advisor for several master's and doctoral students. Doctoral students. He has also served as a research microbiologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, written more than 20 papers in scientific microbiology journals, and has given presentations at nationwide and at worldwide scientific meetings. His expertise is that of organic tissue. Dr. Anderson, welcome here to Crosstalk.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're up here from Arizona right now, and
yes.
I understand you're a listener to Crosstalk in Phoenix area.
Yes, I am. That's what I listen to when I'm driving home.
Well, great. Well, it's good to have you here today. Could you begin just by defining science itself for us? What is science?
I would define science as a tool that humans use to understand God's creation. And what a lot of people talk about when they say science is really talking about the interpretation from that tool. As a tool, it just gives you information. It gives you data. Scientists then interpret that data. They interpret that information. So when someone says science says, you say, no, science doesn't say anything. Science is a tool. Who's doing the saying are human beings called scientists. And they might be right. They might be wrong. They might be understanding the data. They might be misunderstanding the data. So science is not an oracle that, you know, somehow dispenses this truth. Science is a tool we use to understand, and it gives us information we then interpret. And that becomes a key because it's often the interpretation is where differences come in. We look at the same data, we just interpret it differently. Mm-hmm. And we got to recognize that, like anything, politics too, interpretation is based a lot on your worldview. And so how you're going to interpret something, you know, if we're interpreting data from a specific enzyme assay that nobody but three people in the world care about, then your worldview is probably not that big a deal in your interpretation. But if you're talking about something as big as origins, where did we come from? The most basic of all questions, don't be fooled. Worldview plays a key view in understanding that. Even if you have seven PhDs, your worldview still comes into play in how you're interpreting the data that you're seeing.
So when you hear a politician in particular say, follow the science, and whatever the issue may be, because we hear it on many different issues, including from climate change to everything that we've just experienced here with COVID and so forth. What goes on in your brain when you hear that, follow the science? I follow the science, and that means we need to do X, Y, and Z.
Right. What they're really saying is follow what is the popular view among scientists is what they mean by follow the science. And again, sometimes it's right, because certainly we have to give credit that science has, as a tool, been very successful in many areas, including medicine. But we also got to recognize that following the science itself is just a mantra. You know, what are you talking about by following science? What are you saying the science says? And that's back to interpretation when you say, what do you think the science says? So often, follow the science means follow the popular opinion. And that might be right. But popularity, even in science, doesn't mean it's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Creationists have often been accused of denying science.
Yes.
Do they?
Yes, that's the big thing. Of course, that's the pushback. When you're trying to push back against something, you throw up any name you can. I mean, right now, creationists are being called white supremacists. Because that's the current vogue, if you will. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to push back on something, trying to criticize it, you're going to grab anything you want. Because let's face it, God's enemies will use every tool in the book. And so when anti-science or against science, that's just another way of trying to dismiss creationists as well. Because you are against science, then we're not going to listen to you, because obviously then you don't understand the real world. You know, you can have your fake Bible world, but you don't understand the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, we would challenge that we understand science very well. We just have a different interpretation than you do. That doesn't mean that our science, that we're misunderstanding science. It doesn't mean that we don't understand how it works. It just means that we have a different interpretation that you just aren't interested in paying attention to. It's nothing to do with against science. That's just your way of trying to dismiss it without actually engaging our interpretation. Because if you actually had to engage our interpretation, you might struggle some to do that. So it's easier to say, well, you're just against science.
Right,
don't
right.
pay attention to you.
And we hear that often today.
Yes, very often.
Is it scientifically possible to know where life came from?
I would say what we look at is what is it we know about science that tells us where life could not have come from and tells us where life would most likely have come from. So, for example, when we understand what life is, we say, is there any known mechanism, natural? You know, because they're always want to talk about how this molecule reacts with this molecule. So they're looking for natural mechanisms all the time. Is there any natural mechanism that can account for life? And more than even account for life, can account for life transforming into what we see today? And when we say there's no known natural mechanism, which would be my challenge, there's no the mechanism proposed that this mutation occurs or this chemical reaction occurs does not explain it. It does not explain it. When you don't have a known mechanism, then you have to start looking for, well, what would explain it? When you're talking about genetic information, for example, which is one of my specialties, genetic information is a code, kind of like a computer code, except much more complicated. It's not a matter of, well, you're just using the God of the gaps. You don't know where it came from, so God must have done it. No, I'm using what we understand. What we understand is computer codes do not write themselves. That is probably the single most scientific statement I can make. Computer codes do not write themselves. So where do codes come from? They come from beyond the computer code. They come from an intelligence beyond the computer code. That's the only place we know they come from. There's no scientific valid other explanation. So when I look at life and I look at genetic information, I look at the genetic code, it does not create itself. That is unscientific to say that. So therefore, I have to look beyond what would be the natural mechanism to create that, because the natural mechanism doesn't do that. So that means I have to look for what we would understand by all of our scientific understanding, and that is the codes come from a code giver. Well, who would be the code giver if nature can't be the code giver, and it cannot? That's not scientific to say nature's the code giver. Then that means we have to go beyond nature to find the code giver. Mm-hmm. And so now, once we go beyond nature, now we're talking about something that's supernatural. Well, see, in the scientific community, that is, you know, taboo. You can't say that. Well, why not? Because science is only limited to the natural world. Well, who says that?
Hmm.
Where does that come from? That is something you have imposed onto the scientific concept, but it's not part of the scientific concept, because science is a tool. If that tool takes us to something that goes beyond the physical and says and starts pointing to something like a creator, there's nothing in science, as the definition of science or the process of science, that says that it can't do that. In fact, the Bible very clearly says it will do that.
Hmm.
You know, Isaac Newton, considered one of the greatest scientists that ever lived, he conducted a lot of his calculations and he developed a lot of his understanding of the cosmos based upon that he was convinced that it was created and it was predictable in how it was functioning. It was designed, therefore you'd expect to see these kind of hallmarks of design. And he very much would disagree that you can't have the scientific process point to the supernatural, because that's what he was convinced that allowed him to do the signs to begin with, because it was strictly just the universe came about and the cosmos came about by natural mechanisms. There'd be no way of predicting what they did, what they were going to do, what was happening. And so then the universe, the cosmos, would not be predictable. Newton was a very big believer in it's predictable because it was designed by God in a certain manner as how a designer would do it.
Dr. Kevin Anderson, our guest here today, your field is microbiology. Now, many have heard the term of microbiology, but may not know what a microbiologist does. So help us understand the field just a little bit.
Microbiology is, as the name would imply, we study the microscopic aspects of biology. So my specialty, for example, is bacterial genetics. But microbiologists would study bacteria. They would study viruses. Mm-hmm. They would study protozoa. They'd study fungi. They even can get into the field of immunology, because immunology involves cells and it involves the interaction of the body to microorganisms. So all of that's kind of covered in microbiology. And if you get a degree in microbiology, you'll wind up taking class in most of those fields.
So. Okay. So in this field, and as you look at cellular systems, can multicellular systems evolve? I mean, that's the claim we hear, especially when we learn about fossils, someone claims that these are millions of years old, even over a billion years old. Can multicellular systems evolve?
You mean evolve into what we see today?
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay, yes. Even if you start with a multicellular system, which, of course, the challenge is, where would that come from?
Right.
But all right, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that somehow poof, it's there. All right.
Or where you said we have the single cell that you evolved into.
Because even going from single cell to multicellular is not a trivial step by any means. You're changing the total physiology and the total dynamic of the cell to go from single cell to multicellular.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say, poof, we have a multicellular system here, some kind of early organism, supposedly. Now, can it then proceed to evolve into trees and into fish and into horses and into ultimately, humans? And my answer, of course, would be no. And the reason I say no is because they have yet to provide a mechanism that actually does that. The main mechanism that's suggested today would be a system of mutation, some kind of change within the genetic information, the genetic coding of the cell, which does provide changes to its physical features. We call that the phenotype. Changes the physical features. It can change the color. It can change the length of its fingers. It can change the shape of its head. Those are phenotypic changes that can occur because of mutations.
Mm-hmm.
And then supposedly natural selection comes along and says, okay, this one works better now, so this is what I'm going to select for as opposed to all the rest of them. So in other words, natural selection supposedly will select for mutations that make you faster, stronger, fly higher, see better. That's the very generic way of explaining how it supposedly works.
We're going to continue our discussion right after the break. Dr. Kevin Anderson with us today. His doctorate is in microbiology. And after the break, also, we're going to get into this area of organic tissue, especially that which has been found in a T-Rex fossil, even fragments of collagen. What's that all about? And how does that point to refute evolutionary theory? Back in a minute. This is Crosstalk.
Back to Genesis with Dr. John Morris, geologist and president of the Institute for Creation Research. Dr. Morris, how fast did the animals migrate away from Ararat after Noah's flood?
Chris, the Bible tells us that after the flood, God commanded the animals to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And that they did, migrating to fill the earth. There are some modern-day examples of rapid animal spreadings, several coming from the island continent of Australia, which until recently had no mammals. Now, rabbits are nearly epidemic. Another example would be a particular kind of toad that was introduced in Australia back in the 1930s and then just 10 years later was observed over 1,000 miles away. Surely the biblical concept of migration to fill the earth is not only possible but quite plausible. Besides that, it's true because we're told about it back in Genesis.
To learn more about creation, get our free DVD called That's a Fact. Call us at 800-628-7640 and mention the promo code FACT.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Crosstalk on VCY America. Dr. Kevin Anderson, our guest here today, his doctorate in microbiology. And indeed, microbiology points to creation. We'll be getting more into that here on the program today. He is in our area today because tonight he is going to be speaking across the border in the state of Illinois, Antioch, Illinois. And this evening he is speaking for the Midwest Creation Fellowship North. They are holding their meeting tonight in the facilities at Beautiful Savior Lutheran Church. That's on Deep Lake Road in Antioch, Illinois. If you want more information, I understand it is free to the public to come and participate in this. You can go to MidwestCreationFellowship.org, MidwestCreationFellowship.org. You'll find more information about his speaking there this evening. And his topic tonight, are dinosaur protein immortal? So that topic will be delved into here this evening. And also later in the program, we'll give you opportunity to call in with your questions today as well for Crosstalk. Dr. Anderson, we were talking about this matter of whether or not multicellular systems can evolve. And there was something called a break that kind of interrupted our thoughts there. Yes, but go ahead and pick up where you left off.
Well, the assumption is that between mutations enabling physical changes to organisms and natural selection supposedly then picking out the best, supposedly, the assumption is that that means organisms can essentially transform or change, you know, infinitely. They can change into anything. And so there's no reason why if you continue to mutate the DNA that a very simple multicellular organism can't then become fish, which then can mutate more and become, you know, reptile, which then can mutate more and become, you know, a tree shrew, which then can mutate more and become a human. So that's in nutshell the thinking. The problem is, among many problems, the problem I focus in on is that you have never demonstrated that mutations have that kind of capability. Mutations do change the physical characteristics sometimes, yes. Mm-hmm. But every example that I have ever seen, every example that's ever offered in the textbooks, what happens is the mutation is actually degenerative, even if it's beneficial. As example, there's a mutation that will alter a protein on your red blood cell that you actually become less vulnerable to malaria. And we're not talking about sickle cell. This is actually a much better mutation. It's called the Duffy antigen. It's actually a much better mutation. If you don't have that protein, you're less susceptible to malaria. That would be a very positive mutation if you are in an area where there's a lot of malaria. But what happened was it's because that mutation knocked out the production of that protein. So don't offer to me examples of knocking a pre-existing system out as an example of what built that system to begin with. That's like telling a carpenter that knocking this wall out is what built the house. Hmm. No, the wall's already there. All you did was knock it out. How'd the wall get there to begin with? That's what you have to explain. And that's what my challenge is, that evolution has failed to explain where these systems came from to begin with. They're very good at showing how they can get rearranged, how promoters can move around and genes can move around and how we can knock this gene out and how we can do this. But where'd it come from to begin with? Give me examples of the mechanism that built the house, and that they have utterly failed to do. And don't just take my word for it. There is a group of scientists. Now, they're not creationists. Most of them are very agnostic in their, you know, view of God, okay? But it's called the third way of evolution. The third way of evolution. They would agree with me on that. Evolution as it is understood and the mechanisms that have been found are totally incapable of producing what evolution claims to have produced. Hmm. So that's why they're calling the third way. They don't accept what's being taught. They're not going to become creationists. So they're looking for a third way. They haven't found it, but they're looking for a third way.
I know you can save them a lot of time in their search.
Yes.
Let's get into your expertise. Your expertise is actually in organic tissue, and it was back some 16 years ago, 2005, Dr. Mary Schweitzer had reported extracting some pliable pieces of tissue from a T-Rex fossil, even fragments of collagen. Tell us about the significance of this find.
Well, the significance is that up until that point, even though there had been previous reports of it looks like there might be some biomaterial here, it had been discounted. And the reason it had been discounted is because nobody was willing to accept that biomaterial could survive so long in a fossil, mm-hmm. with good reason, because it can't. And the biochemist still could explain to you very clearly why it cannot. And so there was pushback saying, oh, come on, we know that can't be. And when she published her first paper, she, to her credit, had done a very careful job of analysis because she knew there'd be pushback. And so even though there was still pushback, there was less pushback because it's like, okay, we have less that we can challenge because she's done such a good job. And as technology has advanced as far as laboratory equipment, we now have today, for example, laboratory equipment that's much more sensitive, much more specialized, much more capable of analysis than we had 15, 20 years ago. So it becomes even harder to claim that it's contamination or that it's some kind of laboratory error, some kind of instrument error. And so over the years, since her 2005 paper, it's become more and more prevalent in its discovery and more obvious that it is truly indigenous tissue in still remaining in these fossils. But it's still the issue of, but how can tissue survive for millions of years in a fossil buried in the ground?
65 million years.
At least 65. Mm-hmm. They have found tissue in fossils that they date at 80, 120, 250 million years. Mm. Yeah, so it just keeps going from there. It's still got biological material, still got traces of amino acids, still got traces of proteins. We have found, for example, stretchy material that we can literally pull out of the fossil, and it still stretches, still has that characteristic. We have a fossil we found a blood vessel sticking out of. Now, that's not contamination. That's not something that somehow got there. This is a blood vessel. This probably was even an artery that we literally were able to pull out. Other people, other labs have done the same thing. They've extracted blood vessels. They've done the protein, breaking down the blood vessel. It's composed exactly what you would expect blood vessels to be composed of. So there's no way you can say it's contamination when you have that kind of data. So then the question really is, and Mary Schweitzer put it very succinctly in an interview a few years ago, said either we don't understand how fossil material is preserved or dinosaurs are not as old as we think they are. Hmm. Now, the problem is the second, dinosaurs not as old as we think they are, is not really an acceptable alternative. It's not really allowed to be talked about or considered. Therefore, it's really not an either or from the secular scientist viewpoint. It's just there must be some preservation mechanism out there. And you're not allowed to say, well, maybe it's just they're not as old. No, can't say that.
Well, would not bones be fully fossilized after so many years?
One would think it's called replacement, where the bone is really just a matrix of a protein called collagen, and the body then lays down a matrix of calcium and phosphorus on it. So bone's actually living tissue, even though it is mineralized and it's hard. It's not a rock. So when an animal is died and buried and begins the process of fossilization, it's called replacement, where the groundwater brings in mineral from the outside, silica and calcium carbonate and iron and sulfur, and brings that in to the bone and washes out the calcium phosphorus layer in the bone. And so over time, you replace that calcium phosphorus layer with the mineral structure, the minerals that were from the outside. And so the fossil now essentially becomes geologic instead of biological. And as a part of the process, of course, the collagen protein then decays because proteins decay. In fact, if you are a protein chemist, you know that you have to work constantly to keep the protein you're studying from decaying. So that protein decays. And so what you have at the end then is you just have this geologic structure full of silica and calcium carbonate and other minerals from the outside that looks like the bone originally looked. But that's what the fossil is. And so, right, we say, well, how long does that replacement process take? Because apparently, according to the evolutionist community, it must take at least 65 million years, which no one would have ever guessed because we know better than that. It doesn't take that long. And in the process of doing that, how are you preserving the biological material so that there's some still there? And obviously that becomes the contention because we say you don't. The evolution community says you do. They've offered some mechanisms they think work, but they haven't really provided very solid scientific evidence that they work. It's just on paper it looks like it might work.
I'm not a scientist, but I would suggest that the dating methods are flawed.
Yes.
In all of this.
Yes, yes.
I'm sure finding these tissue containing proteins really was a shock to the scientific
world. It was a great shock. Yeah. I mean, Mary Schweitzer was on 60 Minutes because that's how big a news it was, you know, and the interviewer of her on 60 Minutes gaffes when Schweitzer was showing her some videos of literally pulling tissue out of these bones, because we just have this innate understanding that biological systems, you know, that tissue doesn't last that long. Mm-hmm. And so we initially understand there's something peculiar going on. If you're telling me this fossil, this is supposed to be tens of millions of years old, still contains this tissue that you can pull out and it stretches and it has the characteristics of tissue. It still has some of the proteins of the tissue. It still has blood vesseling in it. It still has cells in it. We immediately recognize there's something peculiar going on here because we know better. You know, I remember the little experiment when I was in grade school. You take a chicken bone and a nail and you put them in the ground and a week later they're both gone. You know, so you already understand things decay and they decay fairly quickly unless there's some type of preservation system going on.
Dr. Anderson, aside from this T-Rex, there has been additional evidence, blood vessels or tissue from other dinosaurs. What other soft tissue discoveries have been made?
Yes, there's been a number of soft tissue discoveries in a number of different fossils from a number of different labs, from fossils found around the world. It's not just one fossil in one lab by one, you know, one fossil from one location by one lab. So it's not a matter of that one lab messed up and everybody's talking about that. It's been documented many times by many different organizations, many different laboratories using many different experiments. Mm. It's not just also one experiment that got contaminated. It's many different experiments. It's many different types of analysis. So there's been more than just collagen. There's been other proteins like actin and myosin and tubulin that have been found as well. And many times evolutionists want to get hung up on defending how resistant to degradation collagen is. And of all the proteins in the body, collagen is one of the most resistant. Yes. Now, is it resistant to 100 million years? No. But I have yet to have an evolutionist engage me. And I say this as a challenge, yet to have an evolution engage me on the preservation of actin and myosin and tubulin, because these proteins break down fairly quickly. If they didn't, that steak you're eating tonight would be really, really tough. So those proteins break down quickly, and yet they're there also. So whatever preservation mechanism you're trying to say accomplish preservation of the collagen also has to accomplish preservation of these much more fragile proteins as well.
Is such tissue still being found?
Yes, all the time, yes. In fact, in 2015, there was an article in Nature Communication, which is part of the Nature Journal is the single largest science publication in the world. And they have various side branches, if you will, of publication. One of them is Nature Communication. And they stated that it's the common preservation. So they were even back a few years ago acknowledging that it's common enough that you expect to find tissue in fossils now.
Dr. Kevin Anderson, our guest. I've got a few more questions. We'll also give you opportunity to be calling in short time as well, so make sure you're ready at the phone and be able to respond with your questions here momentarily. This is Crosstalk on VCY America, but how does all of this relate to the age of the Earth? We'll discuss that after the break. You're listening to Crosstalk.
The film, Unidentified, tells the story of two reporters tasked with getting the answers to the claims of UFO sightings. One reporter is an antagonist toward Christianity, the other, a Christian who is challenged on his beliefs.
I'm asking an honest question here, and according to the guru, the Bible says you have to receive Jesus in your life, so either you've done it or you haven't, so which is it, heaven or hell? Come on, Keith, heaven or hell? Answer the question, heaven or hell?
I don't know.
But I thought you were supposed to be a Christian.
Be challenged by the Rich Cristiano film, Unidentified. Available on DVD for a donation of $12 to VCY America. Additional copies to the same address are available for a donation of just $8 more. For your copies of Unidentified, call 1-800-729-9829.
Dr. Kevin Anderson, our guest here today on Crosstalk. He's a microbiologist. He's a director of the Van Anland, Andel, I'll get that right, Andel Creation Research Center. Give us a word about the center itself.
The center is owned and operated by the Creation Research Society. Creation Research Society is the oldest of all the major creation ministries. It was founded in 1963 by a group of scientists, including Henry Morris and Duane Gish, who were very interested in developing a society that was supportive of biblical creation. And as a society, then anybody can be a member of our society that agrees with our position statement, our statement of faith. But as a society, then it's a support organization. It's also a research. That's our one of our big focuses is research like this soft tissue. And like any society, then we publish our own scientific material. It's called the Creation Research Society Quarterly, which is the oldest of the major creation research journals. And a number of years ago, they decided they wanted to build their own research facility. And J. Van Andel, co-founder of Amway, was a creationist. And he was a member of the society, and he funded the building of the first research center. We have since very recently just moved, but it still retains the name of the Van Andel Creation Research Center. And we're now in a new facility on the campus of Arizona Christian University in Glendale, Arizona. And I have a new lab, which I'm all excited about, and we'll be able to get a lot more of this research done now in our new lab.
Wonderful.
And I'm excited about that, too.
And you've got a website where people can check out more information about this?
Creationresearch.org. Creationresearch.org. And that will tell you about us, and you can email and ask questions about us and look at our publications and understand what it is we do and the type of research we're doing and the discoveries we've made.
creationresearch.org is the website. And again, Dr. Anderson is speaking tonight for the Midwest Creation Fellowship North, and that meeting is getting underway at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 6. A Q&A will follow at 8 p.m., and this is being held in the facilities at Beautiful Savior Lutheran Church, 1501 Deep Lake Road in Antioch, Illinois. If you'd like more information about this meeting tonight, it's free, open to the public. Check out the website, MidwestCreationFellowship.org. Again, it gets underway at 7, doors open at 6. This talk of dinosaur tissue and the finds that have come about with the soft tissues, the cells that have been found, discovered, the blood cells, etc., does this lend credence to a young Earth, or... Give us your findings there.
We would say it definitely does.
Mm-hmm.
Because our challenge is that you do not have preservation of biological material for tens of millions of years, that would mean the fossil is not nearly that old. And if the fossil is not nearly that old, then obviously if they've misdated dinosaur fossils, then they've misdated all fossils. If they've misdated all fossils, then they've misdated all rocks, and therefore the whole geologic timescale that we're taught from, you know, very beginning, kindergarten practically, falls down. Now, evolution has pushed back and say, oh, we have all these other dating methods that would somehow trump the soft tissue. Well, first off, I am a biologist. Why would I say that your sedimentation rate or your, you know, other measurement rate trumps my biology? Okay, I understand how proteins degrade. Proteins may be affected by their environment like everything else, but they're not that affected. We have an understanding, a very good understanding of the rate of degradation of proteins. And there is no known natural process that interferes with that to the extent that you get major changes in the rate of protein degradation. That's the chemistry of it. So to be able to claim that somehow these proteins have survived 150 million years, see, that violates everything we know about chemistry. Talk about following the science. To me, the science says, obviously, that fossil is not 150 million years old. Now, people talk about radioactivity. The thing that people don't understand with radioactivity and a radiometric method is general ages had already been assigned to geologic formations long before radioactivity was ever used. See, radioactivity itself wasn't even discovered and proposed as a method until 1907, and we didn't have the technology to do radiometric dating until 1950s. But you can go back to a 1920, 1930, 1940s, even 1950s textbook, and they have all these tens of millions of year ages for geologic formations. Where those ages come from? Pre-radiometric dating, because they use other processes, other assumptions to date. Hmm. When they first began to apply, you know, uranium lead, for example, to date geologic formations, if that method would have given them dates far younger than what they were already expecting, what would they have done with the date? Maybe they were throwing it out and saying, well, this method doesn't work. The fact is it gave them older dates. And see, older is always better. Can't have younger, but older is better. Give them older dates. Oh, it works even better than we thought it would work. So don't tell me radiometric dating is somehow this analytical, you know, objective method of measuring the date of something, because it's a product of the assumption of the date. It's the assumption of how old it is already. And many times you will get more than one date. You'll get a range of dates. Well, which date do you pick? Steve Austin did several samples of rocks, mineral from the Grand Canyon, and got a wide variety of dates depending on the method he used. Well, with method works, which one's the one you're supposed to pick? Is it going to be the one that gives you 100 million or the one that gives you a billion? There's a big difference between 100 million and a billion. Which date is it? And often what they do is they pick the date that fits the best with the assumptions of the rocks around it, which is the same thing. They pick the dates that's best to the assumption of those. And a lot of it ultimately comes back to geochronology, the fossil orientation. Does it contain the fossils that we'd expect to contain based on evolution at the time we're thinking this organism lived? So in other words, we say by evolutionary understanding, this organism lived 100 million years ago, so rocks that are in it are 100 million years old. It's geochronology. And a lot of it comes back to geochronology. That's how in many ways that they will key or they will use as control for their radiometric method. Does it give us the anticipated date? Does it agree with the fossil record? Does it agree with the fossils? Because if you got a million-year-old date based on radiometric dating of a rock sample that contains fossils that you say lived 100 million years ago, you're going to reject the radiometric date. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're going to reject the radiometric date as, well, there was contamination. There's something didn't work. And that happens all the time. So ultimately, even though they don't want to admit it very much, ultimately it really comes back to, it's got to agree with the expected time frame for evolution. And that's also where I get frustrated with what would be considered old earth creationists. They don't believe in evolution. They don't believe that a fish evolved into a reptile, which evolved into a mammal. They don't believe that, but they do accept the large timescale. Don't you understand that large timescale is based upon the assumption that a fish evolved into a reptile, which evolved into a mammal? And some reason they never can quite seem to make the connection. But you see, you can't have one without the other, because the timescale itself is ultimately a derivative of the assumptions of evolution and evolutionary time.
Let's go to the phone lines here today. We're going to open our lines. Our number to Crosstalk, 800-733-9829. If you have a question you'd like to ask, maybe something Dr. Anderson said you just need a little bit of clarification on, pick up your phone. Give us a call here today on Crosstalk. Dr. Kevin Anderson, our guest, our number, 1-800-733-9829. 1-800-733-9829. You have also been involved in the making of Is Genesis History?
Yes.
Comment why you see the book of Genesis so important for today. And I ask that because there are people who said, does Genesis really matter? Is Genesis really that important for us today? We're here. What difference does it make? So comment on how you see the importance of Genesis.
Well, of course, we're here, obviously, but we say what differences make where we came from. Where we came from directly determines our understanding of who we are. If we think we came from an exploded star material, like is very commonly postured out there, Lawrence Krauss loves to claim that, you know, a star exploded, the material got together, formed you, so, you know, forget Jesus, you're here because the star exploded. If that's where we think we came from, you see, then that affects our understanding of who we are as humans. What are humans? We're just a cosmic fluke. Hmm. And as a cosmic fluke, then, you see, really anything's permissible, because flukes don't have moral standards. Flukes don't have any guidelines. Flukes have no purpose in their life. So purpose is simply what I want it to be, whatever I feel like. And during, you know, wake up in the morning, I might feel like feeding the starving the world. Or no, maybe I feel like, you know, killing off the starving in the world. You see, it all just matters of just how I myself view things. So we become essentially our own God. We become our own voice of what is right and wrong. And of course, a society facing that, it's utter chaos. Mm. But if you view that where I came from is I was created, see, that then completely changes your perspective of who you are and why you're here and how you interact with people. And the book of Genesis lays down the foundation of where you came from. It also lays down the foundation of why we see the world as it is today. It's sinned against its creator. Mm-hmm. Sin creates all of this strife, all of this turbulence, and it explains then what we as humans are in relationship to this universe. God's choosing us. This was really built for us in that respect. And it gives, again, a much different understanding of what your purpose in life is. So it's foundational, really, to the whole rest of the Bible. The gospel preachers are saved by grace through faith. Well, saved from what? You know, faith in what? Grace from whom? Mm-hmm. See, the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians said that the gospel is foolishness to the lost. Why is it foolishness? Because the lost doesn't believe that they're created. And when they don't believe they're created, then they don't understand that they've sinned against their creator and that sin separates them from their creator. Well, obviously, the gospel's message of salvation means nothing to them because they don't know what you're talking about, because they don't accept the very beginning. In the beginning, God created you. And because he created you, you are his creation. He's your creator. If I don't accept that, then I don't have any accountability to him. I don't need salvation.
Remember now thy creator in the days of thy youth.
Yes.
And certainly, we've got to get back to Genesis, and certainly we need to recognize who God is and who man is in relationship to Almighty God as well.
Yes.
Our lines are packed, so let's go to the phone lines. We've got Julie calling in from Pensacola, Florida. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I have two quick questions. One is, how wrong can carbon tracking go within the approximate dating in the secular science field? And then the other question is, has there been any frozen animals found within the North Pole, probably dating back to the flood and when the Earth tilted a little bit and possibly tilted a little bit and then caused the North to freeze and animals from, you know, tropical plant areas were found frozen? I don't know if that's true, but is that true that there have been frozen animals found eating?
Thank you, Julie. I'm going to have him respond. There's probably a half-hour lecture right there.
Yes,
but
that is true.
We're actually half
that
a minute before the break,
yes.
So go ahead.
Yes, that's a good series of questions. Okay, carbon-14 very quickly. Carbon-14 has a decay rate of about 5,700 years for a half-life. In other words, every 5,700 years, half of it's gone. So what that means is the entire world was nothing but carbon-14. It would be all gone in a million years. So the secular community says you cannot date these old dinosaur fossils carbon-14 because, of course, it'd be gone within a million, you know, within less than a million years. And so if they're 68 million years old, then it'd be gone. So you can't do that. So they reject the idea that you can use that to date these fossils.
We'll have some more info after the break. Thank you, Julie, for the call. Back in 1 minute. This is Crosstalk on VCY America.
For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House. Our website is worldviewreport.com. This morning, I received a text from the wife of a man that is on the verge of being promoted to captain in the United States Navy. Do you realize what an accomplishment that rank would be? He's worked his whole life to serve our nation and to keep his oath to the U.S. Constitution. And now he's being offered the promotion of captain in the United States military. But he is going to retire and walk away. Why? Because he cannot in good conscience serve and rule over men and be forced to promote critical race theory. I received this text today from his wife, and I know both of them. It's heartbreaking to think of the men that have served in our military who should be constitutional leaders who are walking away because they do not want to run and be part of a military that forces Marxism on the troops. For the Worldview Report, I'm Brandon House.
Dr. Kevin Anderson with us here today on Crosstalk. Again, the website creationresearch.org for more information about their organization, creationresearch.org. Also speaking tonight, check out the website midwestcreationfellowship.org. So, Julie had a couple of questions here. One, though, also dealt with animals frozen in the Arctic. Yeah, what do we know there?
Okay, we'll finish the carbon 14 in a second.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we can finish it now. All right. The thing with carbon 14 is that you do find carbon 14 in many of these fossils, which, of course, the evolution community rejects, saying, "Well, it can't be there." Mm-hmm. So it's obviously contamination. But the problem is the contamination would reveal itself by its very randomness. It would be in this sample, not this sample. It'd be this amount of carbon 14 and then this amount of carbon 14. And that's not what we find. We find a very consistent level of carbon 14 scattered in fossils all around the world, which is what we'd expect if it's not contamination. Mm. So carbon 14 has actually become the creationist friend. The presence of this carbon 14 is not a contamination problem. It's that the carbon 14 is still there because it hasn't all decayed out yet. So that's another indication these fossils, that and the soft tissue, these fossils are not millions of years old. Now, her second question involving then, if I'm understanding what she was saying, there have been a number of animals, mastodons, woolly mammoths, found more toward the Arctic regions that are frozen that still have even digestive material in their stomach. So they were flash frozen. They were frozen very quickly. So the question is that relationship of those with the flood, and I think that's still an open-ended question. Creationists generally accept that there was a climate change that occurred during the course of the flood that led to an ice age soon after the flood, because you said a massive amount of water. We have to recognize the water would have taken a long time to finally drain off. It wasn't like the next day it was gone. Mm-hmm. When Noah finally got off the ark, because it took a little while for the water to even drain so they could get off the ark, when they finally got off the ark, there was still, I'm sure, a lot of water around, and it's slowly draining off. And now that we've had this climate change where many regions are much cooler than they probably were before, more like what we'd see climate today, a lot of that then is going to freeze in the more northern regions. And so there's some still not understanding, and I'm not necessarily the best one to answer this question about what exactly caused the freezing of these animals, mm-hmm. whether they were frozen during the flood or the ice age after the flood. But yes, there has been these animals found frozen. They were obviously frozen very quickly, and we would say that was a result of either the flood or the ice age that soon followed the flood.
We're going to Peggy next. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air, Wausau, Wisconsin.
Yes, I would like to know, please, Dr. Ross, Hugh Ross, keeps promoting that the 6 days were meant really billions of years to prepare Earth for human beings. God had to take all that time to be accommodating for life. I do not agree with that. To me, it's reducing our Almighty God to the inability to just speak, and it became.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see that?
Thank you, Peggy.
I would totally agree with that. I think it is. I totally agree with what she just said far as, to me, that's a slap in God's face to say he would have required all this time to prepare Earth. Why? What's he waiting on? What's he needing to do? What's he incapable of doing that he's going to take so long to do? Well, it's going to take me a while for the Earth to finally get to that. Preparing for what? What kind of preparation was necessary? I believe in a God that can snap his fingers and everything is ready to go. To me, the question is not why would it take, how could he do it so quickly? To me, the question is why did he take so long of 6 days? Because God didn't require 6 days. He could have done it just in a snap of his finger. So, but he explains to us in Exodus why he took 6 days and rested on the seventh because he's establishing the work week. You know, the days based on the solar movement of the spinning of the earth with the sun over, going around. Okay, the month is based on the orbit of the moon, and the year is based upon the orbit of the Earth around the sun, but the week is not based on anything. There's no astronomical basis for the week. Where do we get the week? It comes from God establishing the creation week, create 6 days, rest on the seventh. So to say that God somehow needed all this time to do this, to me, is a direct insult to God. The God I worship doesn't need that. Maybe his God does. I don't know. I'm confused by those kind of claims. The problem is that Hugh Ross accepts the techniques that are being claimed to show the Earth is old without accepting or understanding or admitting that those techniques are very, very based upon evolutionary thinking and geochronology. And he'd be one of them that I would challenge to say, you're accepting he's not an evolutionist. He is a creationist, but he believes there was creation that occurred, and then millions of years another creation occurred, and then millions of years another creation occurred. I say, where are the millions of years coming from? Well, it's because of all these methods. But those methods all rely upon the assumption of evolutionary timescale.
Doesn't that also put death before?
It absolutely puts death before. Mm-hmm. It absolutely does. And they say, well, what God was talking about to Adam and Eve was just spiritual death. No. In Romans, the Apostle Paul is very clear. You die physically because of sin, but you live spiritually because of Christ. Mm-hmm. Most of them, I find, haven't even seen that verse, and that catches them so off guard. You die physically because of sin. Paul couldn't have been more clear. Death, both physically and spiritually, is because of sin. If we say death was something God naturally put in apart from sin, then that means God's the author of death.
David in Superior, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. God bless you both. Dr. Anderson, I have a question, but first I just wanted to posit something.
Tell you what, we've got a minute and a half left.
I'll be real quick. Scripture says a day is 1,000 years, but mm-hmm. God clearly said, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Mm-hmm. So that just blows that out of the water, you know? This is one of my hot topics. I love to speak about this because the people who don't believe how to create a singularity to believe in, which is a nothingness. And so there's no salvation in the singularity. There's no hope in the singularity. And I just don't understand what the best way is to start my conversations with strangers. How do you go about it? I'm very interested in that because it's a passionate topic of mine.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, I wish there was a silver bullet. Different people have different strategies. Often when I'm talking to someone about this, it's because they know my background already. So I'm able to use that as the segue as opposed to just a cold talk. A lot of my conversation, though, because of the my particular position, a lot of my conversation is people contacting me. And so then it's usually a matter of they have a specific question. But certainly the idea is that as a biologist, I understand the biological systems do not do what they're claiming that they do in order for them to create themselves. Biological systems don't create themselves. And biological systems don't transform into a cell to a human.
You're going to have to leave it there. We need another hour, Dr. Anderson. Thank you so much for being here in studio today with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
With us today, Dr. Kevin Anderson. Again, folks, check out the site, creationresearch.org. And we're sorry to other callers. You can follow up through that website, creationresearch.org. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Crosstalk via satellite and the Internet from VCY America. Views expressed may or may not be those of this station. For a CD of today's program, send a donation of $6 or more to VCY Tape Ministry, 3434 West Kilbourne Avenue, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 53208. Or download by RSS or podcast from crosstalkamerica.com. And join us again for Crosstalk.